Welcome to Partially Derivative, the show about data, data science, drinking, and awesomeness, our top data-related articles and blog posts from the past week. And don't forget, if there is anything that doesn't make sense, blame it on our drinking. Links to all stories we discussed today are available on our site, partiallyderivative.com, and on Twitter at PartiallyD. My name is Chris Albin, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Jonathan Morgan. Three announcements for today. First, we are available everywhere. If you listen to podcasts on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or anywhere else, we are available. Come and just go and get us. Second, if you are listening on iTunes, please give us a review. We really want to hear your thoughts, so you know, go on there and write something. It really helps us out. Third, we want your feedback. If you have some really horrible comment about Jonathan or you know something that he said completely offended you, shoot us an email, hello@partiallyderivative.com, or just tweet us directly. Actually, tweet him directly and just make sure he knows. Most important part of this intro, Jonathan, what are you drinking?
All right, Chris. So I just want to say to all our listeners out there that the Partially Derivative Complaint Twitter account is at Chris Albin. So you can send those directly to that account, and we'll make sure to get on that right away. I'm drinking a vanilla porter from the Breckenridge Brewing Company, which is up in Colorado. So it's basically everything you want a porter to be. It's silky smooth. It's just a little bit sweet. I love it. Also, speaking of beers, I can't believe that we didn't know about this before, but everybody's going to know about it now. So our friend, Greg Lamp over at Y Hat, he shared a beer recommender that they built in R. So you can go check it out. It's at beers.yhathq.com. We'll link to it on our website. They also have a tutorial about how they built the recommender in R. So if you're learning data science, it's a great thing to go check out as well. So super cool. Now we can figure out which beers to drink in following episodes thanks to Y Hat.
Data-driven drinking. All right. I have this is a great name, by the way, a Cascaderade by Sudworks Brewing. It is a really awesome, it's probably one of my favorite beers. It's like a Pacific Coast IPA. It's really dry and super hoppy without like being like a big mouthful of husk. And most importantly, it has a lot of sentimental value to me because it comes from Davis, California, aww, which is where I got my PhD. So I have so many memories of drinking beers like this, you know, sitting outside of, you know, some little college town restaurant with my cohort mates talking about some silly thing. So it's a very sentimental taste to me. Sudworks, you are awesome. All right, let's begin the show.
All right. So our first story is about, of course, Deflategate. Data science says the Patriots are big, fat cheaters. Or does it? So, for non-Americans or people like Chris who just don't care about sports, the Patriots are an American football team in the National Football League. So that's the big professional one. The Patriots win a lot. They have a jerk head coach and an uncomfortably good-looking quarterback. So everybody who isn't from Boston pretty much hates them. Plus, they are big fat cheaters. And so if you're a Patriots fan, just go ahead and bring on the hate mail, okay, you guys? Like, I grew up in Cleveland where we have the Browns. So nothing you could say could possibly be worse than living with the football team I already have. So just deal with it. So Warren Sharp at Slate also isn't being very nice about the Patriots, but that's because, according to his analysis, the team's performance this year was dramatically improved because they're like systematically underinflating the footballs they use during the games, hence why the scandal is being referred to as Deflategate. Now, according to Sharp, at least some of the Patriots' stats, like some of their game day stats, would be, and this is a quote, nearly impossible without cheating, i.e., underinflating the footballs. So he analyzed game stats from the past 5 years and focused specifically on fumbles. That's when the player holding onto the ball basically drops it, and found a more or less linear distribution amongst all the teams in the NFL. So the teams that fumble least are only incrementally better than the teams that fumble more often, except for the Patriots. Their fumble per play ratio is so good that the odds of it randomly occurring are, wait for it, Patriot fans, 1 in 16,233.
So, I mean, I don't watch football. I don't really care about football. I don't even watch the Super Bowl commercials. But I have actually been following Deflategate purely because there have been a few really good data-related stories out. And I think it brings up some really important and fundamental statistical questions, one of which was brought up by Kaiser Fung on his own blog post about Deflategate. Specifically, he talks just very at the end, you know, very briefly about reverse causation problems. So I'm going to try to steer away from the super technical part of this. But what we know is that, you know, even it's incredibly rare that the Patriots would have, or it's incredibly, you know, strange that they would have such a small number of fumbles. But that doesn't imply causation, right? You can be an outlier and have evidence of them being an outlier, but you don't have evidence of what happened. And that's sort of the fundamental part about reverse causation is saying, okay, well, we have evidence that something took place, but we don't have evidence of why. We can suspect something, but then we're just guessing. So, you know, we need more data, essentially, on whether or not the Patriots are big fat cheaters or not. I don't know if Jonathan needs more evidence.
Okay, Dr. Albin. So I think correlation doesn't imply causation is like the oldest stats I told you so in the book. And obviously that's true. Just because two things correlate does not mean that one causes the other, necessarily. Because in this case, either the Patriots are some super team that has miraculously mastered the art of holding onto a football more than, by the way, any of the other excellent teams that they play all year, and just happen to have been underinflating their footballs as well, or maybe the team with a reputation for bending, breaking the rules gained some kind of advantage. And I get it, right? This isn't empirical proof, but taking into account the context in which this correlation occurs, I'd call this pretty close to a smoking gun. And also, I am an unbiased hater of the Patriots, so there's that. Obviously, I'm super objective.
All right, with that, hey, we are moving on to story number two. All right, it is time for the biggest R news story that has happened in a very long time. So the open source programming language R is, you know, becoming a big deal in the world of data science. But open source programming languages tend to not succeed on their own. Rather, they require a community of companies to, in essence, be their patron, right? Funding conferences and other events, supporting the development of needed packages, that kind of stuff. They need to sort of be guided through with the company's money. And there's a lot of companies that do this with all languages. But compared to sort of big languages like Python and JavaScript, R is a really small language. And so as such, it's only really had two companies that I would say fit the role as patron. One is RStudio, which makes the IDE that basically every single R user uses. It's awesome, by the way. And the other one is called Revolution Analytics, which does stuff to make R work with big data systems like Hadoop. And last week, the news broke that Microsoft, oh great megacorp Microsoft, bought Revolution Analytics. And wow, this is so, so big. I mean, you know, what is so crazy is that for most R users, you know, most really long-time R users, the idea that R is becoming mainstream is just kind of crazy, right? So a lot of R users aren't this, like, you know, hipster Ruby dev or something like that that's coming in and wants to get into the world of data science. They're some academic who, you know, was using R 6 or 7 years ago while sitting in his quiet college town to run an analysis on some teeny aspect of genetics of wheat germination that no one cares about. And to that person, the idea that Microsoft, like freaking Microsoft, is buying an R company is crazy. So, you know, with that background, you know, that's sort of the important part of it. But the story that I actually wanted to talk about is one by Dan Woods in Forbes. And it's this argument that he makes that Microsoft buying Revolution Analytics was actually the wrong way to make R better. And Wood posits that Microsoft bought the company in order to help Hadoop and R work together on Microsoft's own product, specifically Azure. And, you know, he goes into very technical aspects, and I'll skip over that stuff. But overall, he argues that what Microsoft should have done is actually re-implement R in a way that would make it possible for them to get around R's rather restrictive open source license. So then in that case, they could actually embed R in all of its products, right? You could have R in Excel and R in Access and that kind of thing. That'd be freaking cool. But, you know, first, I will say that professor of wheat germination that I mentioned before, that guy was me. I mean, I wasn't a professor. I was a PhD student. But the general point remains the same. For, you know, basically my entire use of R, it's been separate from the mainstream world of tech. The world of computer science, you know, went on for years, talk about Python versus Java versus C versus C++, whatever. But in academia, you know, a world completely away from that, there was this big community of researchers that was, you know, sitting around using arrows to make assignment, you know, variable assignments just on their own, completely, you know, to the side. And just as an example, when I arrived in my current job, which is an organization teeming with software developers, the first time I mentioned R, I don't think any of them had ever actually heard of it before, right? It was just this weird thing. They probably all sat down and Googled it. And it's not a knock on them so much as a knock on that R wasn't a mainstream thing in computer science. And that has entirely changed now. The second thing that I would like to bring out is about Dan Wood's argument specifically. I think he's right that it'd be really awesome if R was all over Microsoft's products. I mean, that'd be just super cool. But I'm not so sure that's not what they're actually doing. So he posits that Microsoft bought, you know, the company to do this one specific thing, but he doesn't give much evidence as to why. So I think, you know, personally, it's a great move for Microsoft. They could be in a position to be one of the two big companies supporting this open source language that's becoming very popular. And, you know, that extra money they have behind them could be a really big boom for the language. Of course, I'd be less excited if they wanted people to shell out, you know, thousands of dollars to get a Microsoft certified R data science certificate or something like that. But overall, you know, money's good, and I'm glad it's flowing in R's direction.
Hey, man, those certifications are important. Those lead to something. All right, so I actually think it's kind of funny that you mentioned R becoming cool in the context of all of the hipsters that are moving over to data science now that it's the sexiest job of the century or whatever. Because from the perspective of a former hipster coder, like, I honed my chops on a lot of functional JavaScript dudes. So I hear more about R from the old guard of data science. Basically, people just like you described who started doing data science a while ago as part of their PhD before this idea of coding your way through a data set with little script snippets had its own job title. And now that those people are becoming more or less the establishment, I think this move by Microsoft actually makes a lot of sense. So I'm going to go ahead and disagree with Mr. Wood's assessment. They've been developing enterprise-friendly alternatives to trendy engineering tools forever, right? So there's a language called F-sharp that never really caught on, but it's super similar to Scala, which, if you're not familiar with Scala, it's a functional programming language that's used to do lots of big data analysis. The .NET framework Microsoft developers use for web development is basically Django, but Microsoft's version is in their proprietary C-sharp language, which is a lot like Java and blah, 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 right? So this is something they've been doing for a number of years, but that ship has sailed. The enterprise isn't married to Microsoft like it used to be. Open source is actually everywhere. Developers love it, and it's way cheaper than licensing Microsoft products. So this time, instead of going through the process of inventing some new, almost good enough, but kind of disappointing compared to open source language that basically replicates the functionality of some open source technology under this guise that everything they make is enterprise grade, now Microsoft can stay relevant, at least kind of, because let's just point out that they bought an R company just as everyone doing data science is slowly moving over to Python.
Shots fired right at the end.
All right. So our next story is also a very big topic that was in the news this week. Snowpocalypse, or Snowmageddon, or whatever we were calling that great big snowfall that was supposed to happen on the East Coast this week. So for most of the week, I was imagining this post-apocalyptic New York full of steely-faced scavengers and snow zombies and Will Smith hunting down polar bears and this dystopian future. And of course, New York didn't disappear under a glacier. Instead of Snowmageddon, Elsa just sneezed. So nevertheless, this was a great real-life use case for data science. So amidst all of this hell is coming to New York and it's ice crystals hysteria, the BBC ran the cutest infographic ever comparing projected snowfalls and the height of common dogs. So hopefully no dog owners needed this infographic as a reason to keep their pets inside during a snowstorm, but it was a great example of taking something a little abstract.
What would 30 inches of snow really mean?
And making it more concrete.
Oh, it would consume my Staffordshire Terrier. Got it. Thanks, BBC.
Thank you, Chris. So this thing by the BBC was great. And the course, though, the big story was that instead of 30 inches, there was like 5. And how could we be so hopelessly wrong? Well, data science has the answer. So there were 2 great blog posts about this, one by Harvey Enten on 538 and another that goes into tons of awesome statistical detail by Wilson Bentley on Medium. Starting with Harvey's 538 piece, one problem was basically that meteorologists relied heavily on one prediction model instead of looking for consensus amongst many models, which for something as complex as predicting the weather definitely would have been a better idea. So the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting has this model called the Euro. Now, it predicted really high snowfall in New York, like the apocalyptic dystopian future Will Smith hunting levels of snowfall. And because it correctly predicted Hurricane Sandy in the past and some blizzard in 1996 that I guess was a big deal, everybody believed the Euro. And setting aside that 2 is not really a great sample size for assessing model performance, a collection of models, the Short Range Ensemble Forecast, or SREF, had 15 of 21 models predicted less than 18 inches of snow. So as time went on, nearly all of those models in SREF disagreed with the Euro. So probably shouldn't have freaked out and closed the subway. But wait, there's more. This is Weather Hour on Partially Derivative. So Wilson Bentley's post on Medium goes into fantastic detail about the different types of distributions of a data set, like normal or Gaussian distribution versus exponential distribution, and what a single forecast for a single day actually means, framed in terms of probability distributions. And basically his point is that the Snowmageddon forecast, and every forecast for that matter, is basically saying if there were a bazillion Earths with these exact conditions, the peak of our probability distribution says most of those Earths will get a crap ton of snow tomorrow, right? That's basically what that's saying. Obviously, there is a range of potential outcomes, and we happen to be on one of those bazillion fictitious Earths that got a less likely outcome. That, coupled with politicians' likelihood to favor false positives instead of false negatives, because really, who wants to be the jerk who says it probably won't snow that bad and then has to live with the chaos when it does, we get snowperbole instead of snowpocalypse.
Snowperbole, I like that. So I really loved 538's take on this, because I think it demonstrates this big, important part of the scientific method that I think we need to provide more attention to. So in science, we're really trying to get as close to big T truth as we can. But all of our models, even really good models, are only rough approximations of truth. So the strongest evidence that we can provide is when multiple independent models answer the question in the same way. So let's say, for example, you have a bunch of hurricane models, or you have this SREF, collection of models. And if they all really agree, or a bunch of them agree in the prediction, you actually have really good evidence that this is the case. And so, for anyone who's lived in Florida or the Gulf Coast of the U.S. can tell you, like, there is a bunch of hurricanes models out there, and you see them on TV all the time, right? There's this, like, picture of the Pacific or the Atlantic, and there's a bunch of lines going off all over the place. And sometimes, for one hurricane forecast, all the lines are really clustered together and, follow one track. And then sometimes there's all of them clustered together except for one, which is like going off into Germany or something like that. And then other times the lines go all over the place. And, that is really important, because the sort of the convergence between all those lines is really how accurate the meta prediction is. And it's a big deal when someone goes and they say, okay, I have a model that I think shows that this is true. That's, that's awesome. That's the highest thing you can do as an individual model. But the grandest thing is if you have multiple people working on it from multiple sides. And that's what really great research does. And that's something that actually I would like to see more data science do about, okay, we have this one way of going at it and does this, and we have another way of going at it, and it says the same thing. So probably that's how the customer is interacting with the system. That's a great sort of movement going forward.
Yeah, actually, and what would be interesting is then a discussion about how many models are enough to evaluate whether or not an event is likely to occur. And then I guess we should probably understand something about the models themselves. What assumptions are they making? What strategies are they using to find convergence? All of these things are actually useful in determining the likelihood of an event, But when you're talking about something like weather that's incredibly complex and also difficult to assess how right you were because the predictions can be a little bit general, like the hurricane will come to Florida as opposed to some very precise numerical outcome, then it's actually it's really difficult. So as much as we're giving all of these meteorologists and the entire state of New York a hard time, it's a hard problem to solve. Like, let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah, I think meteorologists have the hard task of making a prediction every single day and then hoping they're true, which is, you know, I don't make, quantitative predictions like read by thousands and thousands of people on a daily basis and then get blasted when occasionally I'm wrong. I think meteorologists do well in general.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Story number four, when grandmasters blunder. So I've played chess, right? Rooks, pawns, whatever. However, you know, my chess strategy seems mostly to be moving pieces randomly around the board while having like a really stern look on my face. Like, you know, I'm like channeling Bobby Fischer while just like playing like a 2-year-old. However, at top levels, and I guess at mid levels and low levels as well, players almost always make moves with some kind of reasoning behind it. And in fact, at a very top level, mistakes are very uncommon. And there's even a name for it when a player makes a really dumb move. It's called a blunder. And Joe Dollinger at Medium has this really great post out about tracking when top players make blunders. So some of you are probably now asking the fundamental question, well, how does one define a blunder? Well, it turns out that there is a chess engine that identifies when a move is suboptimal. However, and Jonathan, you'll love this, it doesn't define a move as a blunder or not a blunder, but actually how bad the move was in terms of units of pawns, which this, my friends, is the greatest metric ever. Units of pawns. That's insane. So a bad move could cost you the equivalent of losing a certain number of pawns. What? That's crazy. I love that. So moving on from that amazing metric, the analysis that he does shows that there's this really strong correlation between the numbers of major blunders, which, again, he defines as a detriment of 3 or more pawns as a cost for a move, and the player's overall chess ranking, and that this trend is actually exponential. So there is this model that he's made that actually shows that you know, when better players play, they obviously make fewer mistakes, but also that if at the lower levels, you really want to try to avoid making blunders because the person who makes the blunder has a bigger chance of losing. But at really high levels, no one makes blunders. So your strategy for winning can't be to just make a mistake. You actually have to, you know, be good at chess. And so it's cool. And what actually, you know, what interests me about this is that the author admits that he isn't a data scientist. And he wrote the article probably to highlight a product that he used in making it, just, you know, some platform that he has. But that said, it's a really interesting vein. And he's touched upon something that is a really cool, a phenomena that I think we should explore more, which is the idea of making mistakes. What is the cost of making a mistake? He's quantified the cost of making a mistake in an area that we have tons of data on how people make mistakes. So free dissertation idea to anyone out there. Go explore the cost of making mistakes through chess. I think he's onto this really interesting part.
The interesting tangent to this, I think, is that this is one of the first generations of chess players, the people that are coming of age now playing the game, that no matter how amazing they are, they'll all get blown out of the water by artificial intelligence. And this isn't new. People have been losing to computers at chess for years. But while these players are unfolding some super complex strategy like the Sicilian defense, which admittedly may or may not be super complex, I just looked that up on Wikipedia, the point is that these players think like dozens of moves in advance. So no matter how good they are, we're at the point now where an armchair data scientist can still evaluate the quality of every move they make and pick out their mistakes, even ones the players don't recognize they're making. This is the future, my friends.
The singularity is here, and it is in chess form.
Yeah, so when Mario sits across the table from you, he will whoop your butt at chess. That's a reference to last week, listeners, so you may have to go check out episode 10. Our next story is about something equally as trivial as a game of chess, I think. It's all about why Californian kids are getting the measles. Jokes about disease. So, you guys probably all remember the measles. It was this disease people used to get until about the 1970s. Then we started vaccinating kids, and eventually it was eradicated. But, surprise, it turns out vaccines are, I don't know, bad for your chakras or something, and now there are measles outbreaks at Disneyland. Seriously. So because of that outbreak at Disneyland, and contracting the measles at the most wonderful place on Earth sounds like this kind of bleak dystopian future, everyone is asking, who are these weirdos who don't vaccinate their children? And of course, data science comes to the rescue. So last week, a study found that these like anti-vaxxers, as they're called, tend to cluster geographically, which is really interesting. And then Christopher Ingram at the Washington Post is using data from the California Department of Public Health. And he's not just picking on California here. It actually turns out that they do such a fantastic job making this type of data publicly available that it made for a good use case. He's using that public health information to map those clusters of anti-vaxxers across the state. So I guess when kids go to kindergarten, parents can opt out of vaccinating their children with something called a personal belief exemption. And this is a big deal. This has been in the news for a while. It's called a PBE. And so by mapping the relative volume of PBEs across the state from 2000 to now, he shows how and more importantly, where the anti-vax movement has been gaining momentum. Basically, a chart or a map of where not to send your child to kindergarten if you're interested in them not getting the measles. So I love maps. It's real-world context for data, which makes me happy. And not everyone is familiar with box plots, but everybody can read a map. And these add a significant amount of complexity to your visualization, especially if you're not familiar with geospatial data, which frankly, isn't something that's necessarily a part of every data scientist toolkit. So I think they're often underrepresented in analyses. I mean, obviously people use them, but I don't think as often or as effectively as we could be. And in this case, the geospatial component to the analysis is particularly relevant. And Ingram does a great job using his map to illustrate how this movement is contributing to a spike in the measles cases. So it was a great post.
Yeah, I think we can all agree that maps are freaking awesome. What I actually really liked about Ingram's map is that it didn't fall into this classic trap of being a faux population map. So for those of you who do mapping, this is going to be something that is very familiar to you, that so many maps that we see that show some kind of phenomena, what they really are is they're just, you know, showing where people live, right? That let's say, you know, if you mapped out where people order Chinese food. Well, it turns out that more people order Chinese food where more people live. So there's big spikes in San Francisco and New York. You can't, you know, the point is that you can't say anything with that. But Ingram, you know, doesn't even come close to falling into that kind of basic mistake. He is, by showing the rates of non-vaccinations, he can actually show you what he cares about, that it's not evenly distributed throughout the whole state, you know, through all the different schools in the state, and that, somewhat more terrifying, that it's growing over time. And so it makes a geo-visualization that actually tells a real story rather than just showing that people live in some places and less in other places. All right, last story, the algorithmic CEO. This comes from Ram Charan in Forbes. And I'll admit, when I saw the headline, I kind of groaned a little on the inside. You know, oh, look, here's another big post about big data. It's going to be a big deal. Someone cue the boo-hooed graphic of a man riding a wave of dozens of ones and zeros, or a stock photo of someone in frumpy business wear standing on top of a box labeled big data. But, you know, I actually really like this piece. And despite the title, Chan argues that the big transition we'll see in businesses will come from machines owned by customers talking to machines owned by companies. So instead of, let's say, getting feedback from a user, you know, from user reviews about the widgets that you produce, instead what we'll see is that the widgets that the user installs in their own system talking back to the company and giving feedback in that way with no human interaction. And I think the best example that I could come up with is actually with web analytics. So say you run a major media site. Sure, you could survey visitors by hand, you know, and do some kind of survey like that. But more likely, you're just going to take the data that's shared between your machine and the reader's machine, as in their web analytics, right? Location, IP address, page visitors, you know, that kind of stuff. And use data science to try to figure out how to make your website better. You don't talk to the visitor. You use that communication between the two machines to do the talking for you, and you extract inferences from that. Now, this leads me to Charon's larger and, frankly, probably better point. He argues that this change towards machine-to-machine communication will mean that every company is going to become, in his words, a math house. That is, from the top of the organization to the bottom, the whole organization is going to need to be able to understand and interpret analytics coming from this machine-to-machine data sharing. And what this means is that top-level management can't go out and have, you know, cocktails with their five main customers if they want to get a feel for how the business is doing. Rather, even though they're not data scientists, they have to be comfortable with the idea that looking at that, you know, analysis of how their tools are working in other people's systems, that data directly from the customers, and understanding that analysis and being comfortable to make decisions not on a face-to-face meeting, but from the results of that analysis. And, you know, I'm assuming that he's not assuming that everyone is going to be going to become a data scientist, right? That's sort of this trope that's definitely not going to be the case. But I think he's clearly making the argument that the management can't just be the guy who takes the spec from the customer and gives it to the engineer, like a la Office Space, right? Instead, it has to be in Charon's vision that that management is actually able to understand that data that's coming out of the interaction between the machines of the customer and the machines of your machines and actually drive some kind of insight from that, even if he's not the one actually typing out the code. And I actually really love this argument because it hits on this frustrating part of data science for many of us. That is, everyone says data and data science, big data and all that kind of stuff is really cool. But they don't really understand, you know, what is really important and what it can do for them. And managers think, fine, you know, we can hire a data scientist. But in their mind, I think a lot of them think of it that it just becomes one more report that appears on their desk that they never end up reading. So people talk the talk about big data and data science, but they don't actually see the value behind it. And I think Charon's real insight is that he actually explicitly describes why management needs to take data science seriously. And it's because that your customer insight is not going to come from a business trip to a customer storefront in Des Moines, Iowa, but rather from a data analysis of customer interaction that comes out from the system without you going anywhere. And it comes out in a very abstract way that you have to interpret. And it's actually a pretty rare point for someone to be explicit about where that value comes in. And I liked it. I thought it was great.
So we're definitely still at a point where interpreting the output of almost any insightful analysis takes a significant amount of expertise in its own right, just like you and the author are saying. So even if you're not evaluating the model that makes the predictions, which is probably the role of a specialist like a data scientist, you still need to be able to understand what the predictions mean and how those are relevant to your objectives. So these managers are the domain experts, and they need to have the understanding that allows them to give context to the results of whatever analysis is out there. And I think what this means is that basic numeracy, including some knowledge of statistics and probability, I guess, is going to be a requirement for everyday life, just like literacy is now.
All right. Well, that is it for this week. One sad note, there will be no Partially Derivative next week.
Sad trombone.
Sad trombone. Sad panda. Both me and Jonathan will actually be out on the Kenyan coast, far, far away from reliable internet access. So there will not be any kind of podcasting going on while we're down there. But we'll be back the week after that for more great data science discussions. Maybe not great, decent data science discussions.
My part will be great. Yours might be decent.
Credit for the music you hear in today's podcast goes to Professor Click. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @PartiallyD and visit us at PartiallyDerivative.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @ChrisAlbin and send hate messages to Jonathan @JonathanMorgan. Have a good week.
Bye, guys.